dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. With us today, I'm very pleased to say, as our first guest, is the distinguished former longtime professor at the Army War College, these days a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank, one of the country's preeminent experts on Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union, and an invaluable resource for us, especially about a part of the challenge posed by Russia that is getting scant attention from just about anybody else. But he's giving it the kind of serious thought, indeed some very concerted writing of a new book on the subject of the Arctic and what the Russians are up to there. Dr. Blank, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back. A story that caught my eye prompted me to think we better touch base on what's the latest here, Steve, and that is something that appeared recently in the Reuters wire service concerning a prominent Russian academic, former naval officer, a captain, I believe, before he retired. But he's currently the president of the Arctic Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg by the name of Valery Mitko, who was arrested and charged with high treason by Putin's regime, allegedly for passing state secrets to China concerning the Arctic. Give us a little of the texture, if you would, of this development and the nature of the relationship between the Russians and the Chinese vis-a-vis the Arctic, given how much they seem to be aligning themselves on other accounts.
Well, this tragedy, and it is, reflects, I think, the ambivalence inherent in Russia's attempt to master the Arctic. That's what they say they're trying to do. In Russian, that would be the term they're using. And at the same time, you have this domestic climate inside Russia where it is ever more repressive. And as a result, and this is true throughout Russian history, you have all these people who are in positions of authority or want to be, who are looking to get even or settle scores with somebody else and can fabricate a case that they are spies or criminals of one sort or another. And I think that's what happened to Mitko. He was asked, and I think, you know, in all innocence, to lecture, if I remember correctly, at Chinese University on the Arctic. And he did. And, you know, this kind of thing is perfectly normal. But either he was approached or somebody used this to set up a fabrication that he was approached as a spy recruited to spy for China in the Arctic. And again, this reflects the two sides of Russia's Arctic and Chinese and its China policies. One, in the Arctic is the great El Dorado for Russia. It believes it's going to unlock the key to untold riches in natural gas and oil and minerals and metals and all kinds of things up there, but they don't have the money to develop it. Since the West has imposed sanctions, the Chinese have offered to buy into some of the major energy projects there. The Chinese are also interested in establishing an intercontinental trade route once the Arctic becomes navigable year-round, thanks to climate change, which is what's driving all of this in the Arctic. So, on the one hand, the Russians have to rely on the Chinese to get financing for a lot of their projects. On the other hand, there are obviously people there who suspect Chinese motives and China's ulterior aims. And you also have a domestic political situation where the situation is rife for people to settle scores with somebody or try to see somebody's position and get him out of the way. And, I don't know that we're ever going to get to the bottom of what really happened here, as so many other cases, but that's basically what's happening.
But tell me a little bit more about China's actual intentions vis-a-vis the Arctic. They describe themselves as a near-Arctic power. They clearly, as you say, have ambitions to use navigable waters that are being opened up now to shorten the distances to some of the markets they're trying to serve. But what else do they have in mind vis-a-vis the Arctic, and how does that conflict quite possibly with Russia's efforts to master it?
Well, first of all, for the benefit of the audience, there's a terrific book about China's policies in the Arctic by New Zealand scholar Anne-Marie Brady about this. It goes up through 2018, but it's superb. What China is trying to do, basically, and we see this as a kind of global pattern, is that on the one hand, they have the perfectly normal desire to take advantage of climate change and create a lasting intercontinental trade route to Europe, which would be the shortest possible route, and therefore cost less than what we have to do now, which is go through the Indian Ocean, Suez Canal, and so on. Second, having established themselves as an economic power and as an observer on the Arctic Council, China's ultimate objective is to, as Brady points out, is to write the rules among with other states about what's going to be done in the Arctic, so that they are a major power that has leverage and influence on Arctic destinies and Arctic futures. How do you, you know, who trades in the Arctic? How do you can use the Northern Sea Route? Do you have to pay tariffs to Russia, which they don't want to do? And all kinds of other rules regarding Arctic environment, Arctic navigation, and so on. They want to be a great power in the Arctic, even though they're nowhere near it. That's what the ultimate objective is. Now, to add to this, there is concern, particularly, I think, among the U.S. Navy, that the Chinese might also try to project military power in or through the Arctic, even the degree of sending up nuclear submarines that could target the United States into the Arctic and use the Arctic as a concealment, really, where they could target the U.S. with impunity. Now, the annual review by the Pentagon in 2019 talked about that in passing. There's been some other discussion of that, but that has not yet moved to the front of the center of concern, but it's clearly in the back of, I suspect, the U.S. Navy is mind.
Do you think that it's also in the back of the Russian Navy's mind? Maybe not that they would be using the Arctic as a bastion from which to attack the Russians, but to challenge the Russians' efforts to have a sort of hegemony up there militarily, strategically, in terms of access to resources and so on?
Economically, for sure, and the Mitko affair shows this. There's concern that because they've had to go get capital and technology from China, that the Chinese might end up taking control of some of these major hydrocarbon oil and gas projects. Militarily, if you want to attack Russia from China, you don't need to go to the Arctic. They have a huge border, 4,400 miles, and Russian defense planning, although it never says so publicly, certainly is set up in a way is to deter any Chinese thinking about, you know, moving in and taking Russian territory. So for the from a military point of view, as regards Russia, you don't need the Arctic.
Unless there's a certain encircling as well as gaining control of those resources. This will be the subject, I'm sure, of some of your writings. And thank you for the time you've given us today and for the good work you do, of course, at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. We'll look forward to further visits in the near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about more on China right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's one of the high points of our week here at Secure Freedom Radio, the chance to visit with the great Gordon Chang, one of the country's, well, preeminent thought leaders on, as well as commenters about, what's going on in Asia, and most especially with communist China and what it means for all of us. Gordon is the author of several really important books, including The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. We'll touch on probably all of those topics in the course of this brief visit, but we're always glad to have him with us. Gordon should be followed, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang at Twitter. It's good to have you back, sir. Welcome. Where to begin, Gordon? There's so much to talk with you about. I guess I'd start with Hong Kong. The Chinese Communist Party unveiled on Saturday some of what it has in mind in the way of fundamentally ending the so-called one country, two systems approach to Hong Kong. Tell us what they've unveiled and what it portends.
Well, Beijing is basically taking over national security cases from the Hong Kong government. These cases can be heard in the mainland itself, which essentially means extradition. Extradition is what caused the big protests of last year. There will be a separate court for national security cases. Of course, as we earlier learned, Chinese security agencies are going to be working and have offices in Hong Kong itself, so they'll be openly operating. And we also have got a hint that this will actually become a final law before July 1st of this year, July 1st marking an anniversary of the handover, because the National People's Congress is scheduling a special session. They haven't told us what they're going to consider at that special session, but they're obviously not going to take run-of-the-mill legislation. So we can expect this national security legislation to be finally enacted this month.
Very interesting. There's been talk that they wanted to get it done before the Legislative Council elections that take place in Hong Kong, I believe, at the beginning of September. But that's a much more accelerated schedule, isn't it? Gordon, this raises a question in my mind. President Trump, of course, responded at the end of May to what he called the absolute smothering of freedom in Hong Kong by the Chinese Communist Party. Mike Pompeo on Friday, the Secretary of State, talked about all of this as basically reducing Hong Kong to just another Chinese city. One of the things that the president commissioned in his remarks at the end of last month was a review by something called the Presidential Working Group on Financial Markets to determine what to do about the fact that the Chinese actually have been underwriting a lot of what they do on our capital markets and getting preferential treatment there to boot. The so-called PWGFM, Washington loves its acronyms, the Presidential Working Group on Financial Markets, announced that it was going to take 60 days to think about all this, which would put it into probably the end of the month after this goes down with the legislature, such as it is in Beijing. It seems to me we ought to be getting the answers on what to do about this, namely ending that kind of special treatment, ending China's access to our capital markets right quick here. Your thoughts?
We've been studying this for years, Frank. Everyone knows what the issues are. There doesn't need to be a delay on this. They may be trying to sort of time this until China engages in a provocation in Hong Kong. That might be a political decision. But when it comes to the merits, we know the decision and what it should be. It should be made right now.
Well, I think they're timing it for something, but I'm afraid they're timing it for President Trump's defeat at the polls, which is a pretty nasty bit of business for people in his own administration. Just to keep, you know, business as usual. That's my gut instinct. Let me switch gears, Gordon. You have, of course, written a terrific book about losing South Korea, which is a pretty harsh indictment of its president, Moon Jae-in. It seems increasingly fully warranted, of course, by his behavior. How, in your eyes, is he dealing with the increased belligerence of the North at the moment, Gordon? Is it more of the same in terms of trying to appease Pyongyang and Beijing?
Well, his words have been resolute, but not his actions. Really, what he's trying to do is to restart negotiations with the North, which is really what I think the North has been trying to do to intimidate him. But I think that one dynamic here that's very difficult for him is that, at least for many South Koreans, a new initiative to support North Korea is just not in the cards. And so Moon Jae-in is making himself even less popular. I think we've learned, and the people of South Korea are now saying that Moon doesn't have the initiative, that it's really the Kim family, and that makes Moon smaller in their eyes. That's a good thing because, of course, His goal is to merge the two Koreas pretty much on North Korea's terms. He wants to essentially move South Korea into China's orbit, all sorts of things that would undermine peace and stability in North Asia. So anything that diminishes his ability to accomplish his ambitions is a good thing for the world.
Yeah, two quick questions on that. Gordon, you mentioned the Kim family. One of my guests last week mentioned that it seems as though Kim Jong-un's sister is now being groomed for succession to take over from him for health reasons or whatever. Is that how you see it?
I think that probably is the case. She has been the one who's been ordering the military to act. She is the one responsible for the destruction of the liaison office on Tuesday. And it seems that her brother has sort of melted into the background. Now, this could be a good cop, bad cop routine, but I actually think that it's because Kim Jong-un right now is not in good health. He's disappeared about three times this year from public view. And also, this reminds me, the destruction of the liaison office reminds me of the 2010 sinking of the Chonan, the South Korean frigate. That was intended to show to the North Korean people that Kim Jong-un was ready to take over from his father, Kim Jong-il, then the supreme leader. So this is another act of provocation meant to show the chops of Kim Yo-jong, I think. So we got to be concerned that there's going to be a succession, or at least that Kim Jong-un is not well, and that could certainly scramble everything in North Korea.
Speaking of one other piece of the moon agenda, Gordon, it's been reported that it has had as one of the efforts to curry favor with China, a concerted effort to squeeze Samsung, among other things, now into making chips for Huawei's 5G systems that would be otherwise unavailable as a result of the Trump administration cutting off access to American-made chips. Tell us what's going on there and what it means, not just for the company, but for our security as well.
For much of the 3 years that Moon Jae-in has been president, he's been squeezing Samsung through investigations and through other means. And just to give you one example, some proprietary technology of Samsung was made public by a legislator of Moon's party, the Democratic Party of Korea, and then China then took that and commercialized it within 6 months. So really, this has been a squeezing of Samsung in ways which are really malicious. And there is some suggestion that China eventually will buy Samsung. But there's also, as you point out, in the more immediate term, a possible arrangement where Samsung would be making 5G chips for Huawei Technologies, which is on the Commerce Department's entity list, and which basically has maybe 12 months worth of chips for its 5G base stations. After that, it just runs out. So this is a dire situation for Huawei and for China's telecom ambitions. And so Moon Jae-in is making Samsung ready for the rescue of China.
Which I would think would be a further source of real concern on the part of the Trump administration about the reliability of our South Korean partners, to say the least. Gordon, one other question I had for you. You follow closely, in addition to China, of course, India as a major player in Asia, of course, but also as a prospective serious counterweight, particularly in an alliance with the United States, to Chinese ambitions. Give us your current reading of what's going on. There was some sort of modus vivendi that had been negotiated, and then Chinese soldiers are clubbing Indian soldiers to death and throwing them off of cliffs in a wild melee on that border. What's the latest?
Well, that happened on the 15th. 20 Indian soldiers were killed. 10 were taken prisoner and have been returned to India. We don't know the number of Indian casualties. India has responded by changing its rules of engagement, now allowing weapons within the 2 kilometer band of the line of actual control, which separates India and China for the moment. Also, in India itself, it appears that Huawei is going to lose the ability to supply telecom equipment. There may even be a rip and replace movement. People are talking about a boycott of China. But what was really interesting is that Narendra Modi, the prime minister, gave a speech where he denied that the Chinese were on Indian territory, which in effect is conceding a chunk of India to China. I don't know what's going on, Frank, but this is really an issue that we've got to be concerned about. Because although India is in general moving closer to the United States because of this incident, we don't really know what's happening at the top in New Delhi.
And it's always dangerous to assume that anything that is a kind of ephemeral response to a crisis is necessarily indicative of longer-term intentions and strategy. But it certainly is in our interest, I think, to have a good relationship with India vis-a-vis China. I just wish the Indians were more reliable. That's been a persistent problem for decades, as you know. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us today and for the great Twitter feed that you provide at Gordon G. Chang. I hope everyone will follow you, as do I, and look forward to following you again next week right here at Secure Freedom Radio. Next up, we will speak with Michaela Dodge about developments with our strategic missile defenses, and are they up to the challenge posed by China and Russia? That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of my heroes in the conservative national security arena. She is a relatively young woman, but very accomplished and very smart on things that most of the rest of us are simply not paying much attention to. Her name is Dr. Michaela Dodge. She is a product of the great Van Cleve academic training programs, and she has been at the Heritage Foundation for a number of years and is now with another great organization, the National Institute for Public Policy, where she is a research scholar. I find her to be just incredibly helpful as a go-to authority on nuclear matters, missile defense, and strategic policy more generally. And it's always good to have a chance to visit with her. Michaela Dodge, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Let me ask you about a topic that you addressed, well, you were quoted, I should say, in a piece that was in the Hill last month under the headline, "This is no time to go wobbly on missile defense." And you were pointing out something that I was unaware of, Michaela, and that is very troubling to me, I must say, namely that the National Defense Authorization Act for this fiscal year deviated from President Trump's direction, which was very welcome in his missile defense review, about how to deal with the need to counter the missile threats of Russia and China, not just those of Iran and North Korea. Where are we on all of this, and what's going on the Hill?
So basically the NDAA stepped back the policy that said that our missile defense will be designed against more comprehensive threats to say that it will be designed against more limited threats, and that we will rely on on nuclear deterrence for threats of Russia and China. Well, that's fairly massive scale back for U.S. missile defense policy, because the missile defense review recognized that our policy is sort of a matter of fact, that we don't have enough capability to address Russia and China. But if we did, we left the option open for protecting our nation against Russia and China. And President Trump certainly indicated so in his release remarks when the missile defense review was published.
So you're saying that the policy that had been used by previous U.S. governments, going back, I guess, to George W. Bush administration, when he quite properly withdrew the United States from the defective, obsolete, and ultimately dangerous anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972, which essentially left us defenseless against missile attacks from any quarter. That policy, which said, well, we'll have missile defense, but it'll just be against these third world countries, Iran and North Korea, that's now back as the policy of the United States government. Our missile defense development efforts, as well as our actual deployments, are now being constrained once again by that, well, it seems to me, benighted and reckless failure to address great and growing dangers from Moscow and Beijing.
You know, the policy that was set during the Bush administration was congressional policy from the 1999 National Missile Defense Act. And that act was very specific in that it limited our missile defense policy. We've always left an option open that we would shoot down, let's say, accidental Russian or Chinese ballistic missile. So in that way, you know, it wasn't limited to, let's say, just Iran or just North Korea, as sometimes people state. Now, you know, as far as missile defense policy goes, I have been rather unimpressed with the programmatics on missile defense of the Trump administration. Because basically it's a continuation of the Obama administration's ballistic missile program, and there just isn't much additions being made to strengthen our capability, even on things like space-based sensors that you really need to make the current system more effective.
Especially against the emerging hypersonic and maneuvering threats of Russia and China, and certainly in due course, their proxies, North Korea and Iran as well. So the policy, it sounds, is unset. The program is unset. And the threat is growing by the day. And this is no time, as James Durso put it in The Hill, to go wobbly, using Margaret Thatcher's famous phrase. Let me turn to another topic where we also need some improvements. There is some evidence, Michaela Dodge, that the Trump administration has begun taking seriously something you and I have been talking about for years. You've written extensively on it. I've been worrying about it for decades, namely the lack of nuclear testing, safe, underground, relatively small scale, but realistic nuclear testing to assure the viability of our deterrent forces. What's happening on that front, if anything?
It appears that the Trump administration was having discussions about nuclear weapons testing. It's not exactly clear what the content of those discussions was. You know, I will just say that even the Obama administration did not completely rule out nuclear weapons testing, as, again, some people would have you believe. The policy has always been that the United States should maintain readiness to test within certain time frame should the technical issues raising from our stockpile maintenance and stockpile surveillance activities demand it. And so, again, it is more than proper and overdue that the Trump administration is interested in talking about how could we conduct a nuclear weapons test should we need so. And another, to kind of dispel another myth, a nuclear weapons test is not, you know, necessarily a huge underground explosion in Nevada. It can be a very small yield-producing experiment conducted in the national laboratory. And because of our supercomputers and of our tools, we could learn tremendous amounts of information, even from very small yield experiments. You know, the kind like Russia and China are potentially conducting.
Yeah, I would strike the word potentially. I think there's very little doubt that they are. And we are not at this point, though, because we have been continuing to follow, Michaela Dodge, as you've written about over the years, this unilateral policy of restricting ourselves to essentially no testing that involves any kind of yield whatsoever. And just quickly, Michaela, what are the implications of persisting in that policy?
Well, basically, we're incurring technical cost in not having as competent people to get ready to test when we need it as we could otherwise have. We're incurring cost in terms of understanding potential changes that are going on in our nuclear warhead and in our warheads in our nuclear stockpile. We are forbidding ourselves from potentially designing safer nuclear warhead designs and implementing them. We are undercutting our ability to respond to a potentially surprise developments in geopolitical environment or in technological environment. And, you know, you and I could probably go on and on about all of these disadvantages that you know, that we are incurring. There's just too many of them.
And during this same period, we're watching the comprehensive modernization of both the Russian and the Chinese arsenals, informed by the kind of testing we're denying ourselves, meaning that there are, as you say, not only growing threats, but possibly some very significant surprises in the offing here as well. All the more reason why we better get back in the business, I believe, of doing some kind of testing, maybe at the labs, as you say. Let me ask you finally, Michaela, quickly about a report that our friend Bill Gertz had the other day about Chinese preparations for space warfare. We've seen word of this from the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission last month. We've seen Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, a good friend of both of ours, writing about the super EMP weapons perhaps being used for this purpose by the Chinese in a report that his National and Homeland Security Task Force issued last week. How serious a problem is this, and how aggressively is the United States government responding to it?
Well, you know, obviously it's our massive vulnerability. We depend on a reliable supply of electricity and on reliable satellite functions for all aspects of our lives. It's really once one starts looking into all the things in which we depend on satellites and on our electrical systems, it's really astounding that we have not done more to protect this vital and critical infrastructure. So, you know, it makes sense that the Chinese would exploit this vulnerability, and it makes sense that they would do it in weapons that are just uniquely suited to damaging what we value.
Even if in the course of it they were to damage their own satellites in space, for example, by detonating an EMP weapon there that would clear the heavens, basically, of satellites within view. They have established a capability to replenish their satellites very quickly, and we do not have such a capability as far as I know. Michaela Dodge, we do not have any more time either, which is regrettable because I could go on and on with you. Thank you so much for coming, and I hope you'll do so again soon because there is so much to talk about in this portfolio, and as I say, your work at the National Institute for Public Policy is essential to our understanding of so many of the topics that really require urgent attention. I know you'll keep it up, and I do hope you'll come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Colonel Grant Newsom. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and it's a special pleasure to welcome back to these microphones Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man whose public service and various incarnations in the private sector has been very impressive and very helpful to us in understanding developments in East Asia, where he is based as a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. Grant has worked in Japan for years. He's been an executive director for Morgan Stanley Japan and secretary manager of Motorola Japan. He's also in the past been a foreign service officer. He is an attorney by training and, of course, a very highly regarded Marine veteran and good friend and colleague, member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, among other things. And we always welcome him here with us. Colonel, it's good to have you back, sir. Thank you for joining us. Let me ask you first, if I could, about something that was just announced recently by the Japanese government, namely that it is apparently not going to go forward with a plan to put, I believe it is, two batteries of what are known as Aegis anti-missile defense systems ashore. It sounded as though it had to do more with community concerns about debris falling on the communities as a result of these defensive systems than the need for missile defense or the particular abilities of this system to help Japan cope with those threats from North Korea and China and elsewhere. What's your reading on what's going on, Colonel, and its implications for the U.S.-Japan relationship, if any?
Well, I think the cancellation of the program, I think it did surprise a lot of people, especially those who were going to make some money from the deal. And the excuses that the local population was against it and that it cost too much, those are sort of formulaic excuses, as I see it. I think there's probably some unreported political reason involving domestic politics more than Japan's national security. That's the reason for it. And in fact, I would suggest that this system, while it may have some potential use, Japan's defense has far bigger problems that need addressed. And the Aegis Ashore system is just almost a sideshow compared to the bigger, immediate, more solvable problems that Japan faces defense-wise.
Well, give us a little bit more detail on both the domestic political issues. Do they bear on the relationship with the United States, or do they bear on the relationship between Japan and China? And more to the point, what are some of the yawning problems that you see with the Japanese defense posture at the moment, if not missile threats?
Yeah, what I would say is that these projects like Aegis Ashore, like the Fatenma replacement facility, the Henoko airfield that they're building on Okinawa, the Mageshima new air base that they're building for the Americans, these all take on an aspect of Boston's big dig. They become very lucrative projects, and they attract a lot of take Boston's big dig and multiply it by about 10, and you can imagine what's going on. And I think that has something to do with why it was canceled. Not everyone agrees, but I think there's something to that. But the more important thing is that Japan, what the Aegis Ashore, I think, represents is Japan's preference for buying what I would call silver bullets, or these shiny objects that they think if they buy it, that it's going to make all their problems go away, and it's going to make the Americans happy because it costs a lot. And I think that's been a shortcoming in Japan's defense for many years. And there's, as I noted, there's more immediate problems that need solved and that could be solved and that would do more for Japan's defense. And what are those? First, the Japanese defense forces need to learn how to do joint operations with each other. So the air, sea, and ground currently really cannot operate together. And that is a huge problem. They need to improve their ability to work with the Americans, which, except for the two navies, is currently not very good. And even more troubling is that the military service in Japan is not a respected profession. The terms and conditions, for one thing, are terrible. The pay is very low. Housing's awful. If you have a family, that's tough. So the Japanese defense forces miss their recruitment targets by about 25% every year and have been for a long time. Now, these are problems that really are immediate and go directly to the state of Japan's defense more than a several billion dollar missile system. And if you can't get these things right, I'd suggest there's no hardware solution. And these are things that should be addressed. They could be. And that's where I would encourage the Japanese to focus their attention, and also the U.S. government to work with the Japanese and convince them that these easy things and practical things that have an immediate sort of effect on Japan's defense and also a political knock-on effect in terms of convincing the Americans they're serious, but also getting closer to the Americans and American forces, which would have an effect on Chinese perceptions as well. So that's what I laugh a bit about Aegis Ashore. That's what's behind it.
You know, this is such an important insight, Grant, and I appreciate it comes from a military man, because one of the things that was a takeaway for the United States, well, now probably two decades ago, I would guess, is the need for joint operations, joint capability, communications between the services, commonality between their systems to varying degrees. I would have thought this would have been impressed upon such an important ally as Japan quite some time ago, especially given the presence of U.S. forces on the Japanese islands and the fact that they face a common threat both from China and from North Korea. What's gone wrong there?
It's a shocking omission. And I think the Japanese have gotten pathologically dependent on the Americans to protect them. And the Americans have not applied pressure, persuasion, what have you, on the Japanese to get their act together. It was sort of a situation where everyone agreed to think that everything was fine. And that was all there was. So it really is a shocking sort of lack of attention by the Americans and the Japanese themselves. Have no one to blame but themselves. But once again, pathological dependence does create these distortions. And the two navies, as I said, are the example of how to do things. And the Japanese Navy actually operates better with the U.S. Navy than it does with other Japanese forces. It's really amazing, actually, that anyone joins the Japanese military, given the terms of service. And it's impressive, in fact, that they have as many and as many good people as they do, but the Japanese governments traditionally have really mistreated their military, and the idea is, well, the Americans will take care of things. That worked until maybe 5-10 years ago, but it isn't going to work today.
Yeah, especially under Donald Trump, I don't think. That's very much the antithesis of his attitude, as you know. Before I let you go, just one quick question about the Philippines. President Duterte, of course, has been very much, it seemed, determined to pursue an alliance with China and to dispense with his country's longstanding ties, security ties, especially to the United States. And yet that now seems to be in the process of being reversed. At least maintaining the alliance relationship with the United States seems to be now the order of the day. Tell us what's going on in the Philippines, and is it as promising as it seems?
Well, I think it's promising, and I think given so much of the news elsewhere, I think it's actually a bit of good news that it is nice to see sort of a shift. It's not all the way where it needs to go, but it's certainly different than the sort of these full-throated directions that the agreement that allows the Americans to train in the Philippines was going to be canceled, and to see it be walked back and say not so fast on the Filipino side is a good thing. I think the Chinese have tend to overplay their hand, and they have really done too much to exert their influence, their pressure, their bullying towards the Philippines. I think that's created a fair amount of popular discontent. And also within the Philippine ruling class, you do have always had pro-American people, and they have now got something to work with. The Chinese helped them in that regard. And even President Duterte, he's a mercurial character. And even he, I would imagine, has his limits. He, of course, has his price, but he also has his limits. And I think we're seeing that on display. And it is a nice thing. And you'll see, I think the Americans have done a pretty good job handling this. You'll notice there wasn't any sort of lecturing of President Duterte and hair lighting on fire on the American side. We just took a quiet, mature approach to it. And we're fortunate to have things turn our way for a bit. And hopefully it'll stay that way.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Duterte's price. I'm pretty sure the Chinese will be trying to meet it, so we'll keep holding our breath on this one. But Grant Newsom, your reports from the front lines are so appreciated. I know you'll keep up the good work that you are doing at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, and we'll look forward to further visits with you in the near future. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.